We welcome to our campus this morning Elder Marion D. Hanks of the First Council of 70. This vast audience this morning is an indication of your very high esteem for him as an individual and the confidence you have that you will hear from him a message of strength and courage. It's my pleasure at this time now to introduce to you Elder Hanks.
I appreciate getting to be here in this marvelous opening exercise. Brother Stott and I have followed each other around the country. I appreciate very much his marvelous abilities and his great attitude. I appreciate this opening prayer and am hopeful that I may be blessed through my own humility with that which was prayed for. I suppose a preliminary remark is not alone in order, but almost demanded for you who are here. Some months ago, when I visited, I should like to make this progress report. When I came, I was redolent with the aroma of formula. Things are going well at home. The boy is 8 months old, tall and muscular, and we are seriously considering seeking a position for him selling papers for the news soon. He's that big. There is a story which I learned on a college campus where I first met Brother Stott a long time ago, which I have only periodically remembered, but did remember this morning and chuckled part of the way here. It seems to me entirely appropriate, not just a speech beginner, but an entirely appropriate beginning to what I have to say this morning. It's a story of a man who, like some of us, had examined himself frequently and not been too pleased with the product of the examination. He didn't really think he was up to much. He heard a lot about psychiatric examinations, and though he had never submitted to one, felt sure his diagnosis was accurate. He thought he had an inferiority complex, and he thought about it so much that he finally decided he better see if this were in fact his problem. So he got adequate counsel, sat for many examinations, and when he came for the diagnostic report, sat eagerly thinking he was to be corroborated and said, "That's what's wrong with me, isn't it, Doc? I have an inferiority complex. That's it, isn't it, Doctor?" And the doctor removed his glasses in the approved fashion and said, "No, sir, that isn't your problem. You don't have an inferiority complex. You are inferior." if anyone at this particular time of year is so convinced or has some lingering doubts about the possibility, I'd like this morning to endeavor, out of my own deep assurances and convictions, to dispel them by witnessing to you that you're worth a great lot, that you are infinitely valuable and important in the eyes of God and in the eyes of righteous children of God. That though you may in fact have some things about you not delightful or desirable or admirable or praiseworthy, these are capable of being overcome, and within only the limitations of your own natural endowments, a limitation I think we must recognize, you can overcome, as each of us may, such problems or infirmities as may affect you and your own evaluation of yourself. I listened to a talk in Washington a time ago from Philip Ryan, who's the executive director of the National Health Council. He said there were two key words to our times. The words are change and choice. He noted as an example of the great furor of change in existence in our times that there are identifiable now by the National Council 150 careers in the field of health alone, a great change and a great enlargement of the field of choice over just a time ago, and that in a recently issued manual, there were 50 newly minted names of scientific specializations unheard of a little time ago, from astrobiodynamics to zymocrystallography. There is, in truth, great change and a great increase of choices to be made. I mentioned one other thing Phil Ryan said. He noted that between March 1957 and March 1958, about 33 million Americans, nearly 20% of the total population, changed their place of residence. He noted that as an example of the great changes and perhaps an emphasis of choice, that last year there were some 200,000 illegitimate births in the United States of America and 60,000 new cases of venereal disease. Now, these are unpleasant statistics in a sense, and yet they are symptomatic of the changes and the increased, or at least emphasized, choices that lie before us. Now, my purpose this morning is to attempt to offer you a suggestion or two, good for me, good for the deans and the professors and all of you, about some few constants which need to be remembered, which are in fact keys, not the only ones, but some keys to personal fulfillment and happiness and constructive participation in the church, in the community, in the world. Let me keynote these four simple suggestions with a statement I cut out of the paper by Charles Malik, former President of the United Nations General Assembly. We, all of us, need a mighty spiritual revival. The ideal of a settled, successful, selfish life is wholly inadequate. One craves to see great themes sought and discussed, great causes espoused. One burns for the reintroduction into life of the pursuit of greatness. Everywhere I go, I find people sitting on the edge of their seats, waiting to be shown the way. There are infinite possibilities, both material and moral, to vindicate freedom against unfreedom, joy of living against tyranny, man against all that is subhuman and inhuman, truth against darkness and falsehood, and God against the devil and his works. The time is here, not for pessimism and despair, but for a vast advance on many fronts. Could I add my humble testimony to what he says, that people are waiting and respond when they hear the great simple assurances of God's revelations, which many of us have known most of our lives. And it is always a matter of great wonder to me, knowing my own inadequacies, that they are so eager and responsive to hear what each must know is true, and yet what they are not willing or able to say to each other. We have a particular and peculiar and opportune contribution to make, notwithstanding our own limitations, if we are conscious of that contribution and get ready to deliver it or make it and are humble in the doing. These four suggestions I offer as constants among many, which I believe will bless each of us as we look to our own lives and the possibilities in them for good, for decency, for uplift of other men, for nobility and integrity and idealism, for virtue. Worship, or rather wisdom, I mentioned first, and give it a very oversimplified definition. Wisdom, I interpret to be the capacity to recognize which things in life really matter most, to identify oneself with them, to choose them. There is in the 30th chapter of the book of Isaiah a marvelous statement which I have loved since I read it. The Lord seriously rebukes rebellious Israel. He recognizes their failings, their unfaith, their unwillingness to rely upon Him, their willingness and insistence upon self-reliance to the exclusion of humility before Him. But then comforts them and blesses them with this marvelous promise. Though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not thy teachers be removed into a corner any more. But thine eyes shall see thy teachers, and thine ears shall hear a voice, a word behind thee, saying, this is the way, walk ye in it, when you turn to the right hand and when ye turn to the left. I believe it is possible for anyone in this room to discover for himself what things really matter in this world. I think he may learn it through teachers and through the voice which speaks behind us. What does really matter most? I'm going to give you just one example, and know that you know that this is just a hint. I sat in a seminary testimony meeting many years ago now in Salt Lake City. The hour was 6 a.m. in the assembly hall. We'd chosen the time and the place carefully. We wanted quiet and the surroundings that might stimulate the Spirit of the Lord. I had the pleasure of conducting and turning testimony time to them. I asked them to do one thing, not for me, but for themselves. I said, if no one stands immediately, and this was a group of high school young people, do yourselves the favor of not feeling uncomfortable. Don't stand because the time is wasting. Stand because you feel like it. And if no one stands, sit and think and be grateful. Don't think about wasted time. If we sit here for 2 hours and no one says anything, but you think and are grateful, this will be a profitable meeting. A time passed and no one did speak. Then a boy stood, already shedding tears, a rugged, manly man, one of the leading athletes in Salt Lake City, a student body president, a very attractive human being. He didn't talk well through his tears, but what he said was significant. He said, I've been out in left field and then some recently, and moving farther away. I've been going against the basic convictions of my whole life and all my training. And I've been doing it deliberately, almost diabolically. Recently, a friend of mine came to me. He'd been a teacher of mine once. He said, look, call him Bob, which wasn't his name. I can't make your decisions for you. I can't take your little hand and kiss the delight of the Lord into you. I can't do anything for you but what I'm trying to do, and that's this. You're in the wrong path, going the wrong direction. You know it and I know it, but there doesn't seem to be much anybody can do about it. You won't. Do something for yourself, will you? And if you won't do it for yourself, then do it for me. I'd rather have you do it for yourself. Before you go to bed, every night, whatever time you come in and whatever you've been doing, will you open the Book of Mormon and read one chapter any place and then get on your knees and ask God if this is not His holy word? Do that one thing. There are many things I'd like to say to you, but you're not prepared to listen. But do that for yourself, and if not for yourself, for me. Well, he did it. And he stood there that day to bear witness through his tears and his almost total lack of control that he had found out clearly whether or not God does speak and has spoken, and that this is his word. And this had given him the spirit and the strength to resist the path he'd been on. The second boy who stood, interestingly, was a student body president of another high school. Also a fine, attractive, manly, all-state ball player. He's taught a lesson which you may have heard before. I would hope so. The reinforcement would be valuable. He, too, had tears. He'd been thinking. He said, I've sat here this morning and had a kind of a revelation. There are things about me that aren't so good. I know it. I know that many of you know it. But I haven't been doing anything about them. I've just been acknowledging them. And this morning it has come to me with great clarity that the Lord expects something more of me than that I acknowledge my failings before Him. He expects me to do something about them. He said, I'd like to tell you this morning that I know how much that matters, and I'm going to try. Third boy who stood, I'm a little reluctant to mention. His story is better known, and it would not be well to minimize or in any sense treat it disrespectfully. I ask you that boon. Don't use it lightly, should you recognize him. He stood also weeping, and this in many ways the most rugged and manly man of them all. And he had the hardest time controlling himself. He told how sometime before his dad, a policeman had been shot dead on the streets of the town in which he lived by a cold-blooded, senseless, irresponsible man. And how the hatred had grown in him to the point where it had all but consumed him. How he had spent his hours and nights and middle of the nights thinking of ways to get even with the guy who'd done this to his dad. He thought and he plotted and he planned, and I repeat, was all but consumed by his hate. And he stood up that morning and said, I've found out this morning what Mother's been trying to tell me. Hatred is a foolish, silly, evil thing. No one can afford to hate, not so much perhaps because there are not those who seem to deserve our intense feeling, but because of what it does to him who hates. No one can afford to hate, and I'm not going to hate another minute. I'm going to find a way to get to this man my forgiveness. I'm not going to hate him one more minute. And he sat down. I think I have not been in a more solemn meeting, nor one in which I learned more from these three and others who follow. There are many things we might have said about that which matters most in the world. Let these be a hint. And may I move on to the second suggestion. It is not enough to know which things matter most, or even to choose them and identify with them. One must have the willpower, courageously and faithfully, loyally, to do that which he knows it is good to do. And the illustration here, when I was quite young, I used to carry around little books in which I wrote meaningful thoughts, ideas, sententious sayings that I read or heard. I had joy, and still do, looking at them. I memorized many of them, and one of the most fruitful sources of them was a man named Seneca. Seneca seemed to be a really wise man. I could quote now from that which I learned from the pen of Seneca. But then one day I read the story of Seneca, who stood on the floor of the Roman Senate and justified Nero's murder of his own mother because he, Seneca, didn't have the backbone to stand up for what he knew was right. And although I still admire much that Seneca said, I have no admiration for Seneca. In addition to knowing what it is good to do and be and seek for, one must have the backbone to stand up for what is good and to do it resolutely. There wasn't a perfect person in him who was called Sam Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, but there was much to admire, his magnanimity with Lee. And then one thing he did, I assume it's true, I've known it long and loved it, which makes me think that he was a great man. He sat, so I am told, in a smoke-filled room where a group of general officers had been drinking and celebrating victory. One man, just spoiling to tell a filthy story, stood and said, "I have a story to tell. Is there a lady in the room?" A little facetiously, he knew there was not. But out of the quiet came the voice of Ulysses S. Grant, who said, "No, there is no lady in the room, but there is a gentleman." And the story was not told. Oh, how much of a revolution there would be in the conversations and the contributions between men if those who knew enough to do it had the gumption to say just that much. President McKay said when we were talking about youth fitness a time ago, that flabbiness of character, not flabbiness of muscle, was what was really wrong with the youth of America. And this is being what I believe, in a measure, what I've been trying to say through the country. Now, a third suggestion about a constant which does not change and which should be chosen. The word is short and simple and much spoken of. I mention work, which I interpret to be the capacity to appreciate that nothing worthwhile is accomplished without effort, that there is no excellence without labor. Do you know the famous old story of Euripides and the Pharaoh? The Pharaoh, a man with a good and curious and outreaching mind, summoned his greatest mathematical teacher. He wanted to learn mathematics. He wanted to learn particularly geometry, and so he was taught from the beginning. But he grew impatient with the long, tortuous effort and asked if there were not a shorter way. He was assured there was not. "Ah," said he, "but I am Pharaoh." "Yes, sire," said Euripides, "but there is no royal road to geometry." So far as I have been able to learn in my lifetime, there is no royal road to anything worth achieving. Again, neither my research nor memory assure me that I haven't said this, but I don't apologize if I had. I'd like to, at this particular season and on this assembly, offer you what I believe to be as important a lesson as I ever learned. At the high school I attended, they gave a medal and a watch to one student who qualified as interested in various fields of activity, scholarship, athletics, leadership, and so forth. I learned a few days before graduation that I was a candidate for this honor. This pleased me, of course. I was interested. I was especially concerned, therefore, knowing that I had a chance and the names of some fine people who also were candidates and whom I regarded highly. With the marks I got as I went from class to class on that last day, there wasn't anything else to be done now about activities or leadership. But these marks I knew would be significant. So as they came and were satisfactory, I felt good and encouraged until I got to the last class, taught by a marvelous little soul who taught my oldest brother 17 years before and all of the family members in between. I was the last. I had a great regard for her and had been taught to have by my brothers and sisters down the line, and yet, because this was a class in English literature, a field where I had been particularly interested since boyhood, and because I had read most of the materials that were assigned for the class, I didn't do very much in terms of contribution. I showed up occasionally, but I found many reasons to be away on athletic or newspaper or student body business. When the tests came, I passed them all, got good marks. I had had A's down through the year. I had no feeling that anything else would be forthcoming. But when the report card came back, it had a big fat E on it. Well, I sat shocked and stunned and then laughed nervously and felt sure she was playing a little joke on me. When the class was over and people were showing each other their marks and I was holding mine back, I found my way to her desk and said, "Look, Miss Young," again laughing nervously, "now, this is my report card. You made a mistake." "Oh," she said, "I know it's your report card. And in fact, I have made a mistake. But it was a deliberate one. I wanted you to think a little. I'm not going to fail you in the class. That would put your graduation in jeopardy." She took the report card away from me and superimposed a big C over it. I said, "Look, you you can't do this to me." She said, "Oh, yes, I can." And I said, no, open your book." She opened it, and we went across the page. I said, "Look at the marks, 90, this and this, and compare them with the people you gave the A's to. My marks are better all the way. You can't do this." She said, "Oh, yes, I can. I'm going to do it." I said, "Do you know what this will do to me?" She said, "Yes, I know. Let me tell you something," she said. "I taught your oldest brother, and I've taught all the ones in between. And when I knew you were coming, and I'd heard a little about you before, I was grateful that I'd have the last of the Hanks tribe. Because I've loved every one of them, and I wanted to love you, but you've made it very hard. Do you think that I'm stupid?" she said. "Don't you think I know what's been going on? Don't you think I know the excuses you've made and the unmanly way you've acted in this course? Oh, you made the grades all right. You'd read most of the stuff. I knew that. But you haven't been fair with me or yourself. And I'm not going to mark you this month." I've been tempted every month. "But I'm not going to mark you this month on what you did in comparison with anybody else. I'm going to mark you in comparison with what you should have done. And you get the C." And I said it again. "Do you know what this is going to do to me?" By now I was pretty close to emotion. This seemed so unfair. She said, "Yes," and she shed the first tear and said, "I'd like you to know that I've been up all night thinking about it and that I love you too much not to do it." See, and out I went. Well, I didn't get the medal or the watch. My name isn't on the plaque. Another fellow's is. A fellow came down here and became student body president of BYU and is a great and good man who deserved it, who was a better man than I was. But I lived long enough to stand in front of a group of old ladies, of which she was one, and tell them and her to her face that this was the most important lesson any human being had ever taught me that I remember. That there isn't anything in this world worth having that you can get without working for, without putting out, doing your best. That before God and wise men, we're not going to be judged by what other people do, but by what we do with what we have. The last suggestion, I mentioned worshipfulness. I've talked of wisdom, willpower, work. The W's mean nothing except maybe they'll help you remember. The last thought, worshipfulness, and rather than talk about it, interpreting it as I do, as a sense of responsible relationship to God and other men, I'll illustrate it with this quick story and I'm through. I sat on a ship in the Navy after the war was over. This was the toughest part of the whole ordeal. We were all out there wanting to get home, and we were all counting points and trying to manufacture them. This would mean something only to a few of you. You had to have a certain number of points to qualify to get home until you had a replacement. Everybody was morose, dissatisfied, discouraged. And in the middle of it all, as I sat in a little office, there came a knock at the door. The man who stood there was a great surprise to me, since I'd never seen him in a single service we'd conducted aboard. He had never spoken to me that I know of. He was in a different part of the ship. I saw him infrequently. He stood there, this big rugged boy from the Bronx in New York. Stepped through as I opened the door, and he turned and locked it and said, "Hanks, I don't know you very well, and I've never been to any of the church services you've been conducting, but I got to have some help right now. Got to have it. And the fellas tell me you know how to pray." He handed me a letter, which was the notification from his wife that she and their children had left, made other arrangements, were not longer interested in him, and that they would be pleased if he didn't seek them out when he got home. He said, "I got to have some help. I don't know how to pray, but I want you to help me." This big, tough motor mech and I got down on our knees in a little office in a little ship in the middle of a big ocean, and he repeated words after me, words that came out of me very tremulously, to his Heavenly Father. Somehow, he was man enough and had sense enough to know this ought to come out of him. And so he repeated after me. I hadn't intended it in the beginning. We asked the Lord for understanding, for strength, for courage, for faith, for forgiveness. And he got up, walked out the door, said thank you, walked out the door. And no more occurred. I don't know now very much about Lou, but I know that that did something for me that I needed to have done. It had never occurred to me that it was a skill, a gift, a blessing to be able to get down on your knees and look to God with confidence for help. He didn't know how. And there are many others who do not. In convictions, in the way of life that will give them meaning, in humble prayerfulness, there is available to each that worshipfulness which will be a constant source of strength, a foundation for whatever we may desire to build. I bear you my solemn witness this morning, not from the ivory tower or out of any sense of much personal merit, that I know that there are things in this great era of change and increased or augmented or emphasized choice that are constant and that are keys which can be used to lead us to useful and happy, productive, fruitful lives. I pray, God, for you this morning, out of my sense of respectfulness to what you are and can be, that you will discover for yourself what the voice says and pay attention to good teachers. who can help you discover what matters most, help you to find the resolution to do it, to work, and to worship. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.